Welcome to End of Life University, the podcast where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and thanks for joining me here for episode number 392. Today, I'll be sharing with you an interview I did with Todd Hara, who is a fourth-generation funeral director and the author of a book called Last Rites, The Evolution of the American Funeral. And we have a really interesting discussion. So I think you'll enjoy that one coming up in just a few minutes. First, I want to thank my latest sponsor on Patreon, Heather Capuano. Heather, thank you so much for making an annual contribution on my page at patreon.com/EOLU. I really appreciate the support. And also thank you to everyone else who's been making donations for months and even years now on that page. And a quick reminder that I have another podcast, and I don't have to talk about it very often, but I've had it for the last couple of years. It's What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality. And if you're interested in just listening to me talk and ramble about spiritual issues that I encounter in my day-to-day life, this might be the podcast for you. In the latest episode, I talked about what does it mean to find meaning in our difficulties. So I ponder a lot of philosophical and spiritual questions in this podcast. There are no interviews, just me talking about what's coming up for me in my own journey through life for about 30 minutes a week. So that's What Really Matters. And you'll find it on all the same platforms where you listen to this podcast. And one final announcement, on March 18th, I will be speaking at the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Arizona in Tucson at 9 a.m., giving a talk on fixing our end-of-life conversations, how we can do a better job having those conversations. And it's a free event that anyone can attend in person if you happen to be in Tucson, but also online. And I'll leave a link to register for the event in the show notes. If you go to eolupodcast.com, you'll find the link there. So I'll move on now with my interview with Todd Hara. Stay tuned afterwards. I'll be back for a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm very happy to welcome my guest, Todd Hara. Todd is a fourth-generation funeral director, embalmer, postmortem reconstructionist, and cremationist who works for the family business McCreary and Hara Funeral Homes and Crematory in Wilmington, Delaware. He is the co-author of the Amazon best-selling books, Mortuary Confidential, Undertakers Spill the Dirt, Over Our Dead Bodies, Undertakers Lift the Lid, and most recently, the funeral history book, Last Rites, The Evolution of the American Funeral, which we'll be talking about today. In addition, Todd is an associate editor for Southern Calls Magazine, the Journal of the Funeral Profession. And you can learn more about Todd's books and his work at the website toddharra.com. So Todd, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Karen, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I've been really interested to talk to you ever since I read your book, which is very fascinating and filled with stories and history and things that were new to me, things I didn't know about. And so I'm excited to just converse about that a little bit and a little more about your work and share that with the audience. So maybe I know that you inherited this legacy of being a funeral director in a way, but I just wanted to hear a little more about your choice and what inspired you to go ahead and enter the family business.
Sure, absolutely. I'd be glad to share the story. And you're right. It was a choice. This was not something that I was expected to do. And you know, you hear of all these legacy family funeral homes passed down father to son, father to son. You know, those are starting to become less and less frequent this day and age. We're seeing more first generation funeral directors come into the business. But the business I work for is actually my uncle's business. So my dad is a pilot. My mom was a school teacher. They're both retired now. But, you know, looking back 20, 25 years, I never in a million years thought I'd be doing this. And, you know, people say, well, how did you get into it? And it's, you know, the work, I think, found me. But we do have a very long family history in the profession. My great, great, great grandfather, if you follow that, three greats grandfather, was a cabinet maker down in Milford, Delaware. And as such, when somebody in the community died, they would go to James's house and they'd have a piece of knotted string. And the length of the string would be for the length of the person that had died. And then from knot one to knot two, that would be the length of their head. And knot two to knot three would be elbow to elbow. And then knot three to four would be across their feet. So he would know how long to make it, how wide to make the head area, and then the break where the elbows are, and then down to the feet. And so he would make a custom-made coffin for that person. And, you know, the person would be buried in, you know, a day or two. His son, Isaac, took over the business along with his brother, Harrison. And at some point, we're not sure, Harrison kind of disappears from the family business. You know, maybe he found something else to do, but Isaac continued running the business into the early part of the 20th century. And he was a Civil War veteran. And this is about the time that embalming became, you know, prevalent in America as a function of the war. And so Isaac brings this practice back to the family undertaking business. And, you know, he really grows the business, and he has a nice little business down in Sussex County. Now, our original family business is still in existence. It's changed hands several times. And, you know, there was a couple generation skip in the family business, because when Isaac died, he had one daughter, and he told his daughter, you know, this profession is no place for a woman, which is in 2023 laughable, because 70-75% of all graduating mortuary classes are women. You know, the future of our profession is women. It's going to become a female dominated profession in less than a generation, just based on who's going to mortuary school now. But anyway, when Isaac died, his wife, Rachel, she sold the business, and it, like I said, it's still in existence. But then we see a couple generation gap, and my uncle took up the mantle back in the 70s and purchased a family-owned business that was 100 years old. And out of college, I was looking for a job and started working at the funeral home part-time, honestly, just to make some money. It wasn't a career choice. I was looking at it as a job, and just really fell in love with the profession and what we do and the way we help people. Every day, you know, there's these amazing lessons in grace and humility, and I get to see different people and meet different people, and I'm doing something different each day. And that's, you know, frankly, what attracted me to it and why I still love it. Because honestly, if you don't love this profession, you'll get burned out very, very quickly. I get a lot of young people that come and say, you know, I've decided I want to be a funeral director. And like, that's great. We need young people. I say, but you do realize it's nights, it's weekends, it's holidays. We're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, world without end. And they say, no, that's great. That's great. And sometimes the first call comes in at 2 a.m. and, you know, they decide that maybe it's not the profession for them. So you really have to love it, because it's more than just a career. It's definitely a lifestyle. You know, my family, this is just how we operate our family around kind of the odd hours. And, you know, they're used to me getting called away from the Thanksgiving dinner table, or, you know, coming home at 6 a.m. when they're going to school, or, you know, things like that. It's normal to my kids. They don't know anything different. but it's definitely a lifestyle. You know, I imagine much in the same way, you know, a police officer or a doctor, or, you know, other professions with odd hours are as well. So I'm not saying we do anything extraordinary in that respect, but it's definitely something you've got to kind of mold your life around. It's not a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, it's definitely a profession of service and giving to other people. And I think, you know, thinking back, I don't think I really knew anything about what funeral directors did until I watched 6 Feet Under so many years ago, which that probably really opened a lot of people's eyes. Yeah. It did mine, and I don't even know how accurate it was. But to get a glimpse, in a way, behind the scenes and inside the lives of funeral directors was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when I first began to appreciate, like, oh, wow, like, this is an amazing profession of caring. Like you really do put your heart on the line caring for people. And yet, you know, I always joke, as a hospice doctor, I'm like the least popular guest at a cocktail party, because nobody wants to make small talk with me and ask me what it is I do for my work. But I'm sure you, as a funeral director, it's, I don't know, you might be less popular than I am at a cocktail party. I don't know.
Well, I wrote in the book, and I can't begin to quote myself exactly, but something like, you know, at parties, I don't have anything particularly interesting to say, but people hear you're a funeral director, and, you know, they just want to, they either have all these wild questions they want to ask you, you know, I heard this or I heard that, or they want to come up and share their funeral story with me, along the vein of, I was at a funeral and this happened to me, or, you know, when my grand uncle died, you know, he sat up, and, you know, so people want to come in and they want to share their experience with me. And frankly, I'm honored that people want to come and you feel like they can approach me and share their story, or ask, you know, some really, sometimes they're off the wall questions, you know, just, you know, is it true that you, you know, hang people upside down and suspend them from the ceiling when you embalm them? It's like, no, you've been watching too much TV.
Yeah, I wondered about that, about what are the common misconceptions people have about your work, or even about you, about funeral directors themselves and what they must be like, and some of the myths out there.
So I think the biggest one, and I've already touched on this, is that the entire profession are a bunch of stuffy old men. Well, you know, there's more and more women coming into this profession, and there's certainly, you know, this generational turnover that I'm seeing. And you go into your local funeral home and you're probably going to encounter a woman funeral director. She's probably going to be, you know, maybe in her 20s or 30s, or maybe she's a second career. So it's becoming less of that stereotype of funeral directors are just stuffy old men. You know, we're getting all these young people with these great new ideas, and they want to incorporate technology. So, you know, I'm watching this shift of the profession, you know, before my very eyes. And, you know, the work I do with the magazine Southern Calls, I'm getting to interview and talk to a lot of these innovative people that are doing exciting things. So I definitely have a front row seat to seeing, you know, kind of who's doing what great things in our profession. You know, I think one of the other really big misconceptions of the profession, and this might be a reason that, you know, so many people, you know, come to, you know, say, oh, I want to do this, is, you know, they see the suits and the Cadillacs, and, you know, they see how much a funeral costs, and they think, oh, undertakers are rich. This is an easy job. All you do is stand around, and, you know, you get paid, and you wear a nice suit, and you drive a Cadillac, and, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. You know, people don't see 90% of the work that goes into a funeral is all in the back end. If a funeral is, you know, set up correctly, then on the day of the service, there should really be nothing to do. all the work is on the back end. So people, you know, they see me standing in the lobby wearing a suit and just saying, sign the guest book, please. Can I hang your coat up? But they didn't see that, you know, I was called out at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning to pick that person up. And maybe it was also that Sunday was also Christmas morning. And they didn't see, you know, that I met with the family on a weekend day to arrange the funeral, and that, you know, we had trouble finding the casket. We had to send it back, and, you know, the clothes and everything else, all these little details that go into setting up a flawless funeral. So everything runs perfectly for the family on the day of the service. They don't see all that time and that labor and that work. You know, they're just seeing the end product, this perfect picture that we're painting for people. And that's exactly what we want to be painting for people, that, you know, there's this nice, beautiful, flawless service. And that's the professional service that we're offering, to make it that easy for everyone, to make the service that beautiful for the family and also all their friends and the community members coming in. And you know, frankly, funeral homes, yes, is a funeral an expensive thing to buy? Absolutely. But so is putting a roof on your house, and so is having heart surgery. You know, there are things in life that are expensive purchases, and the profit margins on a funeral are not what people think. You know, you're talking in the neighborhood of like 4 to 9%. Okay. And that money, you know, funeral homes are like little engines in the community. We're very present in the community. So that money's getting dropped back into, you know, sponsorships for the Little League team and, you know, an advertisement in the community choir bulletin and memberships in the Rotary and the Lions Club. So we're reinvesting that a lot of that money back into the community and making ourselves known and present. So, you know, it's not this stereotype of the rich undertaker in the fancy suit just sitting there rolling in the cash. I listened to this podcast called Undertaking the Podcast, and on one of the episodes that struck me, somebody said, you know, you drive into a town, who are the stadiums and the tall buildings? They're named after banks and insurance companies. You never see one named after a funeral home. And that kind of hit home as to, you know, who's making the money? Yeah, the insurance companies, the banks. But, you know, a small local family-owned funeral home, you know, we're making a living and we're charging people an honest price. And, you know, those myths about undertakers being out there to gouge people, you know, it's just not true. It's just an expensive purchase for all the labor that goes into these services that people purchase.
And you're a member of the community and you're there to serve your neighbors. It's not like you're someone coming in from another place. I mean, you live in the community, you help your neighbors and your fellow community members by being there for them at their time of need.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. It is a very community-oriented profession, in the sense, you know, going back to that this is a lifestyle. You know, I'm not clocking in and clocking out. You know, we go to, you know, benefit dinners and Rotary meetings and stuff like that. You know, we're very involved, and not just me, any funeral director. You know, a lot of times you're I'm going to say working, but, you know, you're out there in the community more than just a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and you mentioned the fact that one of your, I think it was Isaac, who brought embalming back to your great, great, great grandfather's funeral business. Yeah. And then you write about the history of embalming in the book, Last Rites, and it's really fascinating. So tell us a little bit more about the history of embalming and how it got started and why do we use it? Why do we embalm bodies?
Sure. So I would say the birth of embalming in America can actually be pinpointed to a specific date. May 24th, 1861 is the day that Colonel Elmer E. Ellsworth was basically ambushed by a Confederate sympathizer, and he was shot in the chest point blank range with a shotgun. And he became the first Union officer casualty of the Civil War. And when his body, this happened in Alexandria, when his body came back to Washington, D.C., an enterprising physician from Brooklyn by the name of Thomas Holmes approached President Lincoln at the White House and asked for her permission to embalm Ellsworth. Now, Ellsworth had been Lincoln's law clerk in Springfield, and he had also served as his bodyguard on his inaugural train ride. So he was a dear friend of the Lincolns, and the president had never heard of embalming before, but he relented and allowed Holmes to embalm the body so the remains could be sent back to Ellsworth's parents in Mechanicville, New York. Now, this is important because at the time, if you were shipping things throughout the country, you were shipping them on the Adams Express. And the only way the Adams Express would ship human remains at this time was if they were in a sealed metallic coffin or they were preserved. And think about it, the war effort's ramping up. So metal is being used to make weapons and ammunition. And it's all being diverted from, there was actually only two places, Crane and Breed in Cincinnati and the W.M. Raymond Company in Queens, that were making these airtight metallic coffins that actually worked. So they're not making as many because they can't get the material. They're still making them, but the people that can get their hands on them, they're frightfully expensive. So really, you're left with the option of embalming. And Ellsworth is embalmed. He's laid out at the White House, okay, with great fanfare. Politicians, high-ranking military officials come view him. And Mary Todd Lincoln comments, "He looks natural. He looks like he's only sleeping." And think about this. Up until this point in American history, I mean, the history of the world, okay, if somebody dies, especially by a violent way of taking a shotgun blast to the chest, within hours, he's probably going to be rendered unviewable due to decomposition, okay? But here he is a day later, and he's in the White House, and he looks so good, he looks like he's sleeping after meeting such a violent end. And this is on Mrs. Lincoln's mind when their son, William Wallace Willie, dies about 9 months later, okay? And they call for an embalmer. This is an almost unprecedented step. Now, as the war ramps up, more and more soldiers are being embalmed so they can be sent home, like Ellsworth. But this is a civilian, okay? There's no real reason to embalm Willie because they're not shipping him anywhere at this point. And he is embalmed, not by Holmes, but he's embalmed by Henry Cattell from Brown and Alexander. And my theory is that Holmes was following the army at this point, embalming other bodies. That's why he was not called, because the Lincolns were amazed at the job he did on Ellsworth. So why not call him again? But that's my thought. So they call another embalmer in. And over the next 3 years, Willie is in the Carroll family vault at I believe it's Oak Hill Cemetery in D.C. And on at least two occasions, the president had the coffin opened so he could view him and spend time with him. Now, when the president was assassinated, these two experiences were on Mrs. Lincoln's mind. Okay, first Ellsworth, then her son. So it almost becomes habit. She calls on the embalmer, Henry Cattell again. You know, it's amazing. Henry was 26 at the time he embalmed President Lincoln. And it's documented that Dr. Brown, who started the firm and was a renowned embalmer, very good embalmer, was at the office when a messenger came to the embalming office and said, "You need to come to the White House." You know, everyone in Washington knew the president had been assassinated at this point. But he sent Henry alone to the White House to embalm the president of the United States, 26 years old, had no formal medical education. So it's just an amazing story. You know, think about what you were doing at 26.
Yeah.
I know I wasn't embalming the president of the United States. So it's an amazing story. And then the president's body is put on a train and taken around the country. It's basically a reverse of his inaugural train ride, but at each stop, there is 11 stops in all, citizens got to view his body. And by my count, 880,000 Americans viewed President Lincoln. It's about 3% of the population of the time. And Americans were simply amazed at what they saw, you know, especially the ones in Springfield. The president had been dead for over 2 weeks at this time. And it was almost like somebody had performed magic, because these people were used to caring for their own dead, bathing the remains, dressing the remains, waking the remains. And they knew what decomposition looked like and smelled like. And so here comes the leader of the nation, and he's been dead 2.5 weeks, and there's no decomposition. He looks like he just died a few hours ago. And you know, people were beyond amazed at what had been done with this. And the thought became, you know, if it's good enough for the president, it's good enough for me. And that's really, I think, kind of the catalyst that really pushed embalming into something that became a staple or a mainstay in American funerary practices. Sure, there were thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers embalmed during the war. By accounts that I've read, only about 6% of Union soldiers were embalmed and sent home. That, you know, turns out to be about 35,000 or thereabouts. So I think if it had just been that, embalming might have just been kind of a wartime curiosity or a wartime technology that might have kind of fizzled out after the war ended and this necessity for shipping soldiers via the railroad ceased. But with President Lincoln's assassination and his grand funeral tour and everyone viewing his body, it almost became, you know, a must behavior that, you know, Americans saw this and thought, well, you know, we want to do this too. We want to emulate the president. And that's really, you know, how embalming took hold here in America. Now, did Thomas Holmes invent embalming? No. Embalming had been in America as early as 1840. A Philadelphia doctor translated Jean Canal's his embalming textbook. It was a French textbook. And he was touring Europe looking for, you know, different sanitary techniques to bring back to America. Discovered this, you know, kind of odd French technique and went to Ganal's cabinet, is what they would call their, we would call it like a museum. Ganal had embalmed specimens and, you know, brought Dr. Harlan in to see the specimens. And Harlan was amazed. And so he brought this kind of obscure European technique back to America, translated Ganal's textbook. But really, it was for doctors to preserve anatomical specimens. People were not really using embalming for funeral practices at this time. But certainly, fast forward to the end of the Civil War, and this is when we certainly see embalming take off and really kind of take hold in America.
And then it seems like what a shift it created in our whole society, because then there was a need to have assistants, to have a funeral director and embalmer who could do that procedure instead of doing a funeral at home. There was a need to have a professional, I guess, someone trained who could help out with that. And you can just, you know, it's really fascinating to just look back and see how it shifted all of our traditions and our rituals, and the fact that you can pinpoint a date in time when that shift began. It's kind of phenomenal in a way.
Yeah. And Karen, the interesting thing is that shift you're talking about, I call it the institutionalization. It wasn't just with our dead. We were doing this with our sick at the same time. You see this shift happening kind of at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. And, you know, Americans before, they lived at home, they got sick at home, they got, you know, elderly and infirm at home, and then they died at home and their family took care of the funeral. Well, you see this shift and the sick are moved to hospitals, the elderly start getting moved to, you know, homes that can care for them, nursing homes, we'd call them today. And, you know, women start giving birth in hospitals. So, and then we also see, you know, the dead being, their care being transferred from the family to a group of professionals in the funeral home.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, it really, that's the point at which the average person began losing their knowledge about death and dying. In a way, death became further and further removed. And now we're at this place where we're trying to educate people and teach people things that 150 years ago they knew and they learned at home. We're trying to get people to wake up and embrace death and dying a little bit more and learn more about it. So it's really fascinating that whole cycle of events that has happened. And I was curious about the fact that embalming made it possible for people to view Abraham Lincoln's body, and wondering if when the custom of having a viewing or a visitation began, how was it around the same time, or how that started?
That's a great question. And that the tradition of viewing the body is as old as humankind itself. If you kind of rewind, his name was Ralph Selecki. He was an archaeologist, and he uncovered human remains in an Iraqi cave that were something like 40,000 years old. And the significance of this discovery was that he found flower pollen around the remains. And this means that these were Neanderthals that he found, Neanderthal remains, that Neanderthals were bringing flowers, picked flowers, and surrounding the dead body. So they might not have been viewing them from the standpoint that they were watching to see if they would wake up, but this is a very early evidence of a funeral practice. But this kind of moves forward as humankind develops, in the sense that until very, very recently, we didn't have the technology to prove that somebody was actually dead. So the tradition of the viewing goes back eons, as family members would gather bedside to ensure that the person was actually, in fact, dead. And that's where the term awake comes from, because you're sitting around to see if the person will wake up. And, you know, in 1816, a Frenchman by the name of René Laennec invented the stethoscope. And it wasn't until 1846 when another Frenchman by the name of Eugène Bouchot put forth the idea of using the stethoscope to determine death, essentially that the heartbeat has ceased and this can be a test of death, an irrefutable test of death. And people were very skeptical. You know, doctors laughed at him. That's ridiculous. So it wasn't really until the mid-19th century that the idea was put forth that we could use technology to prove that somebody had died. And the way families were doing it back then, and I already kind of touched on this, is they would wait for one of the five signs of decomposition. That was kind of their proof positive that somebody was in fact dead and had not, wasn't in a state of what they would call suspended animation. And so, you know, you hear all these wild stories of, you know, people waking up from the dead. You know, if you read 19th century newspapers, and some of them are, have a lot of editorial license, but, you know, I think some of them, there's a grain of truth into a lot of them. And this is where we see the rise of the life signals coffin. You know, there was a brief, very brief moment in time where mortuary technology outstripped medical technology. So people found this need for these coffins that if you woke up in, that you could somehow sound an alarm and be saved from, because they simply didn't trust the medical establishment to prove that they were dead. And the first example we have of this is in 1843, a Baltimore inventor by the name of Christian Eisenbrandt invented the life-preserving coffin. And it was a spring-loaded lid that if your head moved, it would hit a plate and the lid of the coffin would spring open. Well, that's all well and good if you're above ground, but if you're underground, that lid's not going to go anywhere. So that's where the tradition of viewing the body comes from, is it's just an age-old tradition of actually sitting there and ensuring that the decedent is, in fact, deceased.
That's so interesting. I didn't realize that. And I have had, well, I guess I've had the experience of personally feeling that a viewing was really important, but this is many years ago. My father died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. And thankfully, we had a funeral director who was an excellent reconstructionist who did a repair, and we were able to have an open casket viewing, which turned out for me to be really important in terms of the grieving process, just to be able to see my dad and to see him whole, I guess I should say, at the funeral.
Yeah.
And I was have been forever grateful for the funeral director who was able to do that work, because I'm sure it was very challenging. But anyway, I guess my experience is a viewing can be very helpful to people who are grieving, who maybe just need to see their loved one last time. Do you find that to be true?
I do. And, you know, I think it just kind of going back to seeing is believing. You know, one of the important first steps in the grief process is, you know, actually accepting the reality and actualizing the loss. And there's nothing that drives that home more real or more visceral than literally coming face to face with your loved one and seeing that, yes, they are dead. And it's certainly not a pleasant experience in the sense, I don't think anyone looks forward to it, but from the sense that the relief you can get that, you know, okay, I have now accepted that mom, dad, husband, wife, you know, whomever has in fact passed. And that I think is a vital, vital first step into healthy, normal grieving.
And from your experience, are people still having viewings? I wasn't sure if they're very common anymore or if people are getting away from that.
It's definitely mixed. There's still people that see the value in the viewing. And, you know, even if somebody wants what we term in our profession, it's called a direct cremation. So a cremation with no service. We still, you know, have a family member come in and identify the person before they're cremated. And, you know, I tell people, you know, you can go in, you can spend as much time as you want. And a lot of people, you know, find that very healing and freeing, that viewing experience, even if it's not a public, you know, what you think of as the big public wake. Mm-hmm. Just having some private time alone with your loved one, you know, prior to final disposition, whether that be cremation or burial, I think is just vital in the grieving process. And, you know, I advise anyone that's on the fence, you know, you should do it, you know, for your own, you know, health, your own emotional health. And, you know, it's you know, the people that don't do it, you know, I wonder, you know, if we're going to have a generation of people that are perpetually grieving because they want to ignore what I think are vital steps in the grieving process.
Exactly. And our society encourages people to ignore it, I think.
Yeah.
Which is partly why, I mean, you're writing books and we're having this conversation and talking about it because we want to encourage people to take healthy steps around death and dying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, So I just think it's really important that we talk about it. And that brings up another question is, what do you advise people when they ask you if they should bring their children to a funeral? Because I see that come up often. Parents sometimes are not sure what to do there.
I think it's always best to have a frank discussion and with the parents and, you know, say, look, these are your children. This is your family. Clearly, you know what's best. And we can go through, you know, what the pros and cons are of, you know, bringing a child to a funeral. Is it going to be upsetting? Probably. You know, funerals are a place to express public grief. So, you know, they're going to encounter people crying. But, you know, there's other aspects in their life where they'll probably encounter people crying as well. But you can bring it down to a child's level, no matter how old they are, and explain to them, you know, what has happened and allow them to come in and process it at whatever age they're at. I mean, each child's going to process it differently, and they don't have to come in and, you know, view the body. I mean, they could come in and greet people at the door, and that could be beneficial as well. And, you know, we have little coloring books that, you know, are about grief that we give each kid, you know, to keep them busy. And then of course, you know, there's the kids that are so young, they don't know what's really going on. But my co-author of the previous two books I wrote, Mortuary Confidential and Over Our Dead Bodies, he was 14 when his dad committed suicide. And, you know, I'm not talking out of school here. He wrote about it extensively in one of the books, but he got interested in funeral service because of the way the funeral director treated him. And, you know, he was able to process his dad's suicide and process the grief and, you know, find a career as kind of an added bonus just because of the way this and it was a female funeral director treated him and kind of walked him through the process. And he has very, very vivid recollections of what she talked to him about that day. And, you know, I think that's a very powerful example of how, you know, just having an honest conversation with kids. I mean, they might be young, but they're not stupid. They know what's going on. I have two kids, you know, one's 10 and one's 8. And believe me, they know more about funerals than most adults from growing up.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. and they hang out at the funeral home. But, you know, I still, you know, address everything death related to them at their level. But I think they have a very healthy understanding and appreciation of death because, you know, that's what dad does.
Yeah. And I, you know, that was true for my children when they were small and I'm working in hospice and talking about death and dying. And I feel like it's so healthy and we need more parents to recognize this and get comfortable talking to their kids about death and dying because it will change everything as they grow up and become adults themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing that I'm seeing that concerns me right now are people choosing not to have funerals. I have friends who have said, I don't want a funeral at all. Don't have one for me. And I feel like the funeral is an important ritual for the family, the survivors and the loved ones to come together. And so I just hate to see that the funeral being dismissed as something that's not necessary any longer.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. And, you know, to your listeners, you know, they might be thinking I have an agenda, right? You ask a barber if you need a haircut, what's the barber going to tell you? So you ask a funeral director, do you need a funeral? What are they going to tell you? But, you know, I've seen firsthand, you know, the value and the healing power of a well-executed funeral. And, you know, it's a good funeral accomplishes several things, and all these things are really to set the person or the family up on the first steps of their grieving process. This is kind of really not even starting the grieving process. This is setting them up for a healthy grief journey. And you know, the benefits of a funeral are it's a public space to grieve. It's a safe space to grieve. You're supposed to be grieving. It's a funeral. So it's okay to cry and let your neighbors and your friends and your family members show up and you all can cry together. So you can kind of express that emotion. The other thing is it allows a forum for community support. Okay. You're advertising a time and a place for people to come together and show solidarity for your loved one that passed, and everyone that's there, that person who the funeral is in honor of, they touch that person's life. So the family members are looking around and saying, wow, you know, my mom, my dad, my husband, my wife, they touch so many people. And, you know, that's meaningful. That's powerful. That's impactful stuff there. I would say the other thing is the public announcement has a lot of value. And when you're advertising a funeral, you're making a public announcement that, you know, the community has lost a member and the member of the community did this. Their job was this. They volunteered to do this. Their church was here. So people have a sense of where that person's role was in the community. And the family gets a chance to almost withdraw that person's role from the community. They're saying this person, they're now gone from our community and we're publicly telling everyone. And it also saves the family from having to keep tell the same story. My dad died. My dad died. My dad died. Everyone knows it's been shared on Facebook. It's been in the newspaper. If anyone still reads the newspaper, you know, it's been on the internet. So the community knows now, William Worden organized grieving into different tasks. Are you familiar with the tasks of his grieving? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So accept the reality of the loss, process the pain, adjust without the deceased, and reinvest in the world. So two of those tasks can be addressed at the funeral. Accept the reality, okay? You've got somebody lying in a casket for a viewing. As I said before, there's no greater reality than that as far as facing that a death has occurred. And the other thing is to process the pain. And that's jumping back to creating a safe space for grieving. People can begin to process the pain with their peers, with their neighbors, with their friends, with their family members by expressing that grief and starting to let it out. And that's when you're getting set up for that kind of first step in your grief journey is, you know, if you get used to starting to let it out at the funeral, hopefully that will continue as you continue on in your grief journey and you get used to letting it out when it hits you. Because as I'm sure you've talked about on your show before, you know, the grieving is not linear. It can hit you at any time. And you just need to become very, good or adept at letting the grief out when it comes.
And I think you're right. The funeral itself normalizes the fact. It sort of announces to everyone that you are a person who's grieving right now. I mean, and everyone at the funeral is grieving in their own way as well. But I think that makes it more acceptable in some ways to view yourself as a grieving person out in the world and to be able to let other people know and also to be able to be gentle with yourself as you're going through the process.
Yeah. And something that I found very interesting, the Victorian people were very good for wearing mourning clothing, and touching on being gentle with yourself, that was a very tacit sign to let the community know, hey, these people have suffered a loss. We need to be gentle with them. The Victorians, they also would put a crepe swag on the door to let the community know, hey, this is a house in mourning. Again, letting the community know, be gentle with these folks. But I definitely think that's, you hit the nail on the head saying, you've got to be gentle with yourself too. You're in mourning. So give yourself a pass. You know, if you find yourself crying in the middle of the day, that's okay. You know, it's okay.
Yeah, definitely. And it makes sense to me that the funeral can set the tone for how you view yourself in a way as a person who's grieving and mourning out in the world. Yeah. So any thoughts about, this is an evolving field, evolving kind of rapidly these days, it seems like, in terms of disposition of the body, but also people having home funerals and a lot of options we haven't seen before. And I know, COVID started some of these changes, like streaming funerals online. So I don't know, any thoughts about where we're headed or how you feel about some of the new things happening out there?
With new things, I'm going to divide those into two baskets, kind of the more tangibles and then the intangibles. So for generations, people had one option when it came to disposition. You could either be buried or you could be buried or you could be buried. Okay. Then in the late 19th century, we see the first crematorium open up. Cremation starts to very, very, very slowly gain popularity and then really starts to kind of explode, hit its stride in the 1960s. So now Americans have the option of being buried or being cremated. But there are other disposition options that are opening up to Americans now. Aquamation. Okay, so that's alkaline hydrolysis. Sometimes it's called flameless cremation. So it's a water cremation. That's legal in 22 states. And then we have NOR, so natural organic reduction, human composting. That's legal, I believe, now in 5 states, maybe 6. So there's new disposition options opening up to people that just don't want burial or cremation. So when people say, what's changing in funeral service, I feel like that's usually what they're talking about, kind of that tangible, what's going to happen with my remains, okay? And then, of course, I always hear the people saying, well, I told my wife to just throw me in, in the trash can out back, ha, 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 right?
Yeah.
So... And then there's kind of the intangible that's happening in funeral service. And that, I think, is technology-based. You touched on it during the pandemic. We had to start live streaming funerals. Now, I would say before the pandemic, we maybe live streamed 2 funerals a quarter. Okay. It was very infrequently. And then all of a sudden we had to do it. And so now a family walks in the door and they're already expecting that we're going to offer live streaming as a matter of fact. And, you know, that's great. We do it, you know, and it's great to connect people across the country and across the globe. But, you know, I think the funeral of the future probably is going to exist in the metaverse, you know, in a virtual reality space, you know, where you're sitting on your couch with your VR goggles and, you know, I'm sitting on my couch with my VR goggles, but we're both in the same viewing room, quote unquote, or viewing space, if you will. Maybe it's a tropical island, a virtual tropical island, offering our condolences to Mrs. Smith, who just lost her husband. I also see holograms changing the face of funeral service. I think it was the Kardashians, for one of the Kardashians' birthdays. There was a hologram of that was made. And, you know, I think we might start to see the decedent making an appearance at their own funeral to sing a song or say a few words. Or so I think hologram technology will definitely change funerals in the future. And maybe even as far as memorialization, you scan a QR code on a monument and maybe a hologram pops up, or, you know, maybe the decedent then recites you a poem on your smartphone or something. So, you know, I definitely think the metaverse and technology is going to shift the way Americans memorialize their dead moving into the future. And it's going to continue in the way that it's always continue, in the sense that, you know, Americans are going to keep the traditions that make sense, the ones that work, and they're going to discard the ones that don't. So the funeral service always has been and always will be kind of this evolving thing. The funeral has never been static. It's always been something that's been changing slightly year to year. But if you look at snapshots of the funeral from today to 50 years ago to 100 years ago to 200 years ago, you're looking at vastly different experiences. What people's expectations were, how they grieved, how they interacted with each other and the dead during that funeral experience is all very, very different in each of those historic snapshots. And that's going to continue to change as the funeral experience, you know, continues to change with the times and the technology.
Well, Todd, I really appreciate your grasp of the history, for one thing, which is amazing, because I can tell you've done extensive research just from reading the book and all the stories that you've included in the book. But I really appreciate your thoughts about where we could be headed in the future. And it sounds like your willingness as a funeral director to go wherever go wherever it's necessary to go, because that's what's happening. But we're running out of time, so I just want to say thank you so much for joining me today and talking with me about the book and the work that you do. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on. And just as a final thought to all your listeners out there, just remember, the funeral is for the living, and it's a ritual, it's a tradition that has evolved over the years to make the grieving process easier. So people say, oh, so-and-so, you know, my husband, my wife said they didn't want a funeral. Just remember, it's not for them. It's for the living. It's to help us process their loss. And that's the power and the value of a funeral.
And in a way, like a funeral could be one last gift that we give our loved ones, like by either planning it ourselves or encouraging them to plan something that would be meaningful for them. So I think that's a perfect message to end on. So thanks again, Todd.
And, oh, you're welcome.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And actually, I'll remind everybody, the book is called Last Rites, The Evolution of the American Funeral. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. The Evolution of the American Funeral. And you can go to toddhara.com to learn more about it. So thanks again and take care.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Todd Hara. I was really fascinated by his book and the many stories it contains about the evolution of the American funeral. And I think you'll find it an interesting read, too. I've chosen it as one of the books for a year of reading dangerously this year. And I wanted to say that in all the conversations I've had with funeral directors here on End of Life University, I'm always so impressed by the passion that they have for their work, for this true calling of service. And Todd fits in with all the others that I've spoken to. And I'm going to link to some of those previous interviews I've done with Caleb Wild, Eric Layer, Amy Cunningham, and Caitlin Doty, amongst others. And so if you're interested in hearing more from other funeral directors about their perspective on this work, you might like listening to some of those previous interviews as well. And I will say that while I myself am really passionate about non-traditional funerals and burial, particularly as choices for myself, I realize that we need every option. We live in a very diverse society here, and we need all possible options available for people in order to meet their needs. And so traditional funeral homes play a really important role in our communities and in our society and in helping all of those people for whom a home funeral and a non-traditional burial are just not possible and not feasible. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. And a quick reminder to subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen, and also to tell others about the podcast so that we can grow this community of people who are working together to change the way we talk about and care for each other at the end of life. So I'll be back next week with another interview for you. And until then, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.